Thank you to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Alexis is a mother, survivor, and victim advocate from Chicago. This is the first time that she has ever shared on a public platform about the abuse she faced when she was a child. Her healing journey was extensive and seemingly never-ending, as she was often met with disbelief. However, after decades, she was able to see her abuser finally put behind bars. Still, her healing and advocacy continue as she works to break cycles in her own family. Alexis's courage and strength amidst all that came next for her are a true example of the power of resilience.
My name's Alexis. I am 31 years old. My friends would say that I'm outspoken, overprotective, kind. My wife likes to say, sometimes to a fault, outgoing, pretty daring. I grew up in Chicago. My biological father and mother were very young when they had my brother and I. I'm a twin. They married, I believe, at 19. They divorced fairly young as well. During that time that they were married, I remember it being a hostile environment. When they did split, the arrangements seemed to be back and forth a lot. My dad had us every other weekend. I have memories of my brother waiting for him a lot. I can say that it wasn't consistent. We were with my dad on his schedule. My mom did introduce us to her boyfriend at the time. I had to have been 4 or 5. The time alone with my mom, I recall it being short. But my mom's new boyfriend was extremely nice. He also has a daughter, which I very much welcomed. If you ask anyone today, she is not my stepsister. She is my full blood sister. We have an awesome relationship still. I called my stepdad, dad, immediately. My mom was really taken aback by that. That household that my mom and my stepdad provided was a lot of really great memories. They did Wednesday nights for game night so that we all bonded as a family. My stepdad worked as a truck driver overnights. So my mom took care of us during the day and my stepdad at night. This is when every other weekend I would have arrangements with my dad. The first apartment that my dad lived was with his mother and brother, my uncle. He had actually gotten shot when he was between 18, maybe early 20s. My uncle had a child prior to his shooting. The mother was always around. After he got shot, he lost use of his legs. He had to use a wheelchair. He needed assistance with daily activities, such as using the bathroom, changing, getting in and out of bed or into his chair. He used his palms a lot to grab items like cups or anything he needed to grab. It was very clear that he didn't have the same mobility that someone who can move their fingers. This actually led up to the abuse fairly quickly after the split. It was Easter. We got there late and my dad was in a rush. He had told my brother to play video games. I was told to go take a nap. I recall going there, him pulling his wheelchair aside of the bed. I remember trying to dive myself into a song that I was listening to on the radio because I had this mentality of go to bed, go to bed, go to bed, and squeezing my eyes like I'm supposed to be sleeping. That was the first time that my uncle sexually assaulted me. My mom had put a dress on me. I had tights. After the incident had happened, I had came out of the room. My dad was ironing his clothes. He yelled at me, "Where's your tights? Whoever said for you to get undressed?" My initial reaction was, "Oh, sorry." I can't recall what I was thinking, but I remember turning to the iron, which my dad had left unattended. I put the whole palm of my hand onto the iron. I can't remember it actually really hurting. And my dad was just yelling at me, "What are you doing?" From that day on, I didn't want to go to my dad's. My mom would tell my dad all the time, "She just doesn't want to go with you." I remember a lot of times my dad yelling at me and telling me to get in the car, that it was his weekend. A lot of times I did have to go. This was constant. These situations with my uncle, he always found a way. He was the cool uncle. All the kids come to him. If they needed something or wanted something, he would try and provide. He had this bag of markers, and I loved coloring. That was my thing. And my twin brother would be in the living room playing his video games. So I felt like my uncle always had something for him to be distracted. He would use those times to take advantage of me. Also, I mentioned that he did need help using the bathroom. I do recall a situation where I would have to hold like a little short handle bucket, and it would capture the urine. And it wasn't until later on that I realized, like, I should not have been doing that. Also, when we would take family pictures, because he's in a wheelchair, it was always like, "Alexis, get on your uncle's lap." I cringe when I think about it, but he would use that time to keep me close to him. The perception to everyone else, though, was he's just being a loving uncle, and that's Alexis's favorite uncle that she always wants to be around. I think that was a sign. I have to forgive myself for the things that I should have seen because I was so young. This felt like normal to me. As unfortunate as that sounds, this felt like this is the way it's supposed to be. This is just my relationship with my uncle. And now that I'm older, I have to give myself that grace. It took a very long time to say and even admit to myself what was happening.
Around the age of 8, 3 to 4 years after the abuse began, Alexis had an interaction with a preteen neighbor that caused her friend worry. Her neighbor, who she still calls a friend to this day, immediately brought Alexis home from the playdate to repeat to her family what Alexis had reported to her. Shortly thereafter, Alexis's parents called a family meeting as a result.
I came home and was bombarded. I was in shock, confused of why the house was so full, especially with family members from both sides, because the bitterness between my parents and especially between both my dad's now wife and my mom's now husband. There was just so much animosity between them both because of the schedule and all the things in between divorce. I knew then that something was wrong because my heart was out of my chest when I saw my uncle's wheelchair. That was the one memory that I focused and zoomed in on. I was told to go upstairs. I ran into his daughter who smacked me, and it really occurred to me what was happening. I sat on my bed with this heavy feeling I wanted to lift out of my body. I was almost hyperventilating. The scared feeling that I had to even walk down the stairs which seemed like a lifetime. When I got downstairs, my uncle was at the edge of the table. My mom, my stepdad, my dad, and his wife were standing up. When they sat me down, they'd asked me directly what I had said. When I had repeated what I said to my friend, he had started sobbing. His exact words were, "How could I even do that?" The silence in the room, besides his cry, that's when everything started to just become a blur. I remember looking at him and feeling panicked, sunken into myself. Then out of the background, I could hear someone say, "Grab a paper and draw it out." When I drew the very exact placement of his bedroom, which I would have been 4 or 5, this was the first incident. And mind you, I at the time was in third grade. When I drew it, it was the very exact placement of his bedroom, where I was and where his chair was placed. I could hear him cry even louder. I could hear everyone, "Well, are you sure, Alexis? Was this a dream?" I just started panicking and started grabbing words that I could hear, which was, yeah, it was a dream, it was a dream. But I made it all up and it didn't happen. I just wanted to disappear. I remember them telling me to go upstairs. Eventually, I would have to go back to my dad's. And when I did, I was labeled as being dramatic. She just wants attention. I remember taking a lot of the anger out on my dad's wife because she began that bullying. And then it became constant. Nothing I said was real anymore. I became bitter and angry. The summer of third grade going into fourth grade was my first attempt of suicide. My sister came in the room and held on to me. I was tired of being bullied. I was tired of not knowing where to place my feelings. I had actually attempted, I believe that year, 3 or 4 times. My sister saw 3. I struggled a lot during those years. I had once been a straight A student. By sixth grade, I was flunking every class. I stopped doing homework. I was developing an eating disorder. I always would sneak snacks. I would make a bowl of Chef Boyardee and then hide it under my bed because we had this rule, once the lights are out, you're not allowed in the kitchen, you're not allowed to eat. But even after dinner, I was sneaking cookies in my pillow. So I was finding different coping mechanisms and I couldn't sleep. I would stay up all night playing Sims on the computer or staying up and watching Svengoolie. If you're from Chicago, you very much know who that is. The eating, all these responses, I don't think anything was made to believe this was a result from what happened, because this was always made to believe that this never really happened to me. So in my head, for a very long time before anything comes out, I struggled with how could I have some kind of traumatic response to things. My bad grades wasn't because of this, because did it really happen to me? I struggled with that for so long, trying to understand why I was the way I was. Right after our 8th grade graduation, we left Chicago and moved to Missouri. I was very lost and I was trying to renew myself. I again went down this really bad spiral. I was self-medicating. I was very out of control because of the anger. I didn't know where to place it. I've actually, in the years, have reached out to these people that I have fought and explained, like, "Hey, I'm really sorry. I was just a very lost kid. I take responsibility for my actions."
Thank you to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Did you know that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat? That bacteria can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses, and it is just gross. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, eco-friendly bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters, that prevent 99% of bacteria and require 3 times less laundry. Using silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA, Miracle-made sheets are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long, so you get better sleep every night, and your sheets stay cleaner and fresh 3 times longer than other sheets. Plus, they are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands, and they feel just as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some 5-star hotels. Sleep clean with Miracle. Go to trymiracle.com/WCN to try Miracle-made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo code WCN at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Remember, just go to trymiracle.com/WCN and use the code WCN to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/WCN to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
I was about 15. I had came home from school and I kept in contact with one of my neighborhood kindergarten friends. She called me and she had said, "Alexis, you need to sit down." She had warned me and sent the news of my uncle being arrested for trying to kidnap 2 little girls.
In 2010, Alexis's uncle was out on bond in Chicago for a predatory criminal sexual assault case. According to the Chicago Tribune, while out on bond, Alexis's uncle was then accused of trying to abduct 2 young girls by snatching their small dog away from them and telling them they had to get into his van to get their pet back. He was immediately jailed for the offense. However, what came next is both shocking and heartbreaking.
I was in complete shock. My stepdad was still living in Chicago because of his work. He had came down and he was standing outside on a porch with my mom. I remember feeling angry. My mom was crying. My stepdad looked at me for a brief second and then just looked down at his feet. He could not keep eye contact. I remember having a very straight face and just being like, "What do you want now?" I felt like when there was emotion in the room like that, I just shut down because of the anger I've already had with these experiences. My mom got on her knees and she was apologizing. She was begging for my forgiveness. She said that she knows what I said was true. I remember having no emotion. She was hysterical, but I felt fucking cheated. I felt angry. Like, why now?
There was so much lost in those years that you weren't validated and heard and believed.
Right. It was like, okay, now that you're almost growing into adulthood, we're going to try and understand you and help you. There were so many emotions at that moment. I didn't even want my mom to touch me. That's how angry I was. When she got up, that's when she had told me that more of my cousins had came out with their own stories. I can't even tell you the anger that I had felt when they were telling me these cousins were going to court to testify against him. I just had this question, what about fucking me? I felt like, was I just not important enough? I was very insistent and anxious because I wanted to know so much about what was happening. I don't even know when they had started the trial. I was just told that they were going to trial. That period of time, he was bonded out by my father. They bonded him out, which would come to the attempted abduction. Then he ended up back in jail. It was a very hard pill to swallow because I felt I had cheated myself from the actions of another person. I had again started attempting suicide and one left me institutionalized. I was inpatient. I had been taken back to Illinois because of the arrangement between my mom and my dad. When I was in the hospital, my dad had actually came to the inpatient, quote unquote, to visit me with his mother. But this was during the trial and after I found out about the attempted kidnappings. That's what we were talking about. He was like, you need to tell them that this didn't happen. According to the article that I had read, the van was jammed from the inside, so you couldn't open the door. You can only open it from the outside. And he was trying to convince me that wasn't planned. I was sitting there in this shock that these two people were in the room that I wanted nothing to do with.
I imagine when your dad is saying that to you, that must have been absolutely maddening. You're already at a point where you feel invalidated, disvalued. For him to enter that space where you should have been healing, he comes in and invalidates you much further and then asks you to invalidate yourself.
Yes. And mind you, a trial no one wanted to give information about. What really angered my mom, and I'm so glad that she stood up for me because that sits with me even now. She found her voice for me, and I won't forget it. When they visited me in the hospital, my mom came in as soon as they were leaving and let the doctors have it. She was like, they are not allowed in this hospital to visit her ever again. They denied access to them because she had told them that they are going to trial for the very reason why I was there. The way my mom stomped in there and gave everybody hell, I won't forget it. That was also a big part of, damn, I'm validated right now. That was really where my process started to begin. It was like, okay, Alexis, it happened. Where do we go from here? For the attempted abduction, I found out later on the arresting police officer did not read his Miranda rights. So that's why that case was dismissed. The police officer was off duty and so happened to be there and stopped what was happening. He actually never got charged for that, which is really unfortunate. All of these events were happening and I was kept so far away from it. When I came out of the hospital, I now had been given the tools of better coping. So I came out of this stronger. I 100% give so much credit to several counselors there that I will never forget. I can't even express my gratitude for the tools that they provided me with. I came out of there so determined to understand and figure out where things were. My mom and my stepdad were in between wanting me to know and where do we protect her. I went to the DA myself to ask questions on this trial. Now, at the time, because it's an active investigation and it's an active case, she could only provide so much information, but she did ask me what my incidents were. After I provided her the details, she did tell me that due to the statute of limitations, there was nothing she could do for me. But she did ask me about the use of his hands. I know she hated to ask the detail, but she had needed to because he was trying to say that he was not capable of these incidents because of his hands. She said, if there's anything you could show that he can make such movements, it would be really good for the case. When I left that day, I left with a mission and was thinking, I'm going to get this motherfucker. If it's the last thing I do, I went home to my mom and was like, where's all of our old photo albums? When I pulled them out, I was up till 4 a.m. I found a particular picture where he's sitting in the backyard of my mom's old house. Those beer mugs that are very heavy, that have that extra thick glass at the bottom. He's holding it using the thumb and the front of his palm. You could see his fingers slightly bent to grip the mug. I went to the DA. She saw the picture and was like, that's it. This is going to be very useful. She was very excited about the picture. And I said, okay, keep me updated. I did not get an update. It wasn't until late in high school, back in Missouri, and my mom came to me and told me that he had been convicted. I had mixed emotions. I was happy. Hell yeah, this motherfucker's going to jail. But I found out how short the term was, 7 to 10 years. I found out later on that he was only charged with one of my cousins on one account when she was, I believe, going for four. I learned that the two cousins made their cases separate. One of the cousins' case, I'm angry for her about it, but the case, I believe, was dismissed. The second cousin, that was her long battle that kept him in trial. A lot of the fight in that trial was the statute of limitations. That's the part that angers me still. On all these technicalities, he walked away with the very minimal sentence. He definitely deserves way more time than he received. It was infuriating because all these things he got away with, we live with for the rest of our lives. A couple years ago, I got into contact with these two cousins. I actually did meet with family members. I can't say how thankful I am to these cousins and my aunt that were going through the trial. They are still helping me heal today because of the timeline that I had so many gaps where things were missing. We were kept in the dark so long. I have to constantly go back and forth with family members and get my answers. Maybe I won't ever get those answers. I had asked my mom, hey, when did I stop going to my dad's? She didn't really have the answer, but my brother remembered. That to me was like, oh, thank God. Even the slightest little information can go such a long way for somebody that has these experiences. We're finding this comfort in each other without even having to say much. I find that so beautiful because he's taken so much from me. I remember hugging my cousin so tight. I didn't want to let go. It was a hard thing to address the elephant in the room. It could be a hard pill to swallow sometimes, but we find peace in being able to talk to each other because I feel it was a very big tactic that we were kept separated. I feel like there was a lot of guilt on both sides. I felt guilty for not being there for them, and maybe they felt the same. I have to say that with all the answers that are coming to light, it is really important for me to bring this story out because I feel our biggest struggle was being believed. If you are a family member, give them that safe space. Be there. You don't have to have answers or know what to say. Sometimes just giving that I'm here for you goes such a long way, and it can give us the courage to say, these are my questions. That's what I learned with my aunt and my cousins later on in life. The amount of support that they are providing me to move forward and to empower yourself. For anyone who's been through the journey, it's not a walk in the park. It is difficult and has many years of different phases. I struggled with relationships, not only intimate or with my partners, but with family, with friends. I don't keep friends along. Even now, I'm more an open book to how I feel and to what I have to say because of that validation I finally got after so many years. The biggest part of the healing, allowing yourself to be open when it comes to different kinds of abuse. It's so hard to tell yourself that you're worthy of it. I had been in a toxic relationship. Not that she was a bad person, but we both were unhealed. After that toxic relationship, it was very important to me to tell myself in the mirror every day, I'm worthy of being loved. I'm worthy of the family I want. I had told myself that I wasn't going to want kids after I started processing everything. And then I became empowered in my mid late 20s. I was like, no, you're not going to take my life from me. I'm worthy of being loved. I'm worthy of being married. I'm going to have as many kids as I possibly can. I have had amazing people that have come into my life. Some that are still around, some that aren't so much, but they have helped me acknowledge, hey, Alexis, this is not a healthy way of dealing with this. I am so very lucky and blessed. I just started tearing up. I met my wife about 6 years ago. She has been my biggest part of my healing journey. When I met her, I was coming out of this drinking and I don't care phase. She was very much on my side, showing me a different lifestyle, showing me a very close family that's very open. If there's anything you need, they're ready to be there for you. That has been extremely healing because I know that it exists. We're now married and we have a child. It has just been such an amazing journey with her and her family. I have a very close knit of friends, and these women that I surround myself with empower me every day. I hope that they do hear this because I don't think I express it enough what they do for me, the way they carry themselves. I now have role models.
When you come from broken family systems or hindering family systems, you can't really fix that shit unless you practice it to be in a relationship that is healing and safe and open, that gives you that space to do that. That is a massive piece of healing. I am so love that you gave yourself that gift, and you attribute a lot of it to her and family. And I love that. I am not negating that in any way. But a lot of people who go through trauma close themselves off to that kind of love. I want to honor the fact that you were able to leave yourself open and recognize healthy love and work on it. That's so huge.
So glad you pointed that out, because in the beginning with my wife, God bless her heart, on the days that I wanted to just run and leave, she was so patient with me. What I love about her, she'll give light to a situation, say, babe, you can definitely go about this in a different way. She's like, I know that this is what you're used to, but you can do it like this. I need time. And then when I come back, I'm like, you know what? You're right. This is my natural response. But I was able to take that and say, I can change this response. We actually got married of December 2021. We did a quick wedding, but we are still actually going to be having a big wedding. We did it more so for the name of our daughter, all being one family name. A lot of people tell me, your child, she's just so happy. I can't express how happy and healing that is for me too. When I see my nephews, I'm always making sure that they have a safe space. I try also to remind them about their boundaries. Like, hey, if I'm making you feel uncomfortable, if I'm too loud, tell me, then we can talk about it. I would look up his mugshots that they post online. I felt like I just had to double check to make sure he was still in jail. I had received a call during the pandemic. I believe it was summer of 2020. I was told that he was going to get released, but they didn't have room for the transitional housing. So he hadn't been released yet. He was released in December of 2023. As angry as I am about the lack of protection, I met with my aunt a couple weeks ago, so February of 2024. She told me that he had not been registered. They did not know where he is. My dad, with his mother, they were definitely trying to protect him. When it comes to family dynamics, I feel there's a lot of protection and there's a lot of taking of the sides. It makes sometimes healing so much longer. I haven't found it in my heart to forgive my grandma. In my mind, it was just like, okay, I've gone past that point with you. I wanted no part of my dad's side because I now have a child. It's just impossible for me.
I don't believe we ever have to forgive our abusers. I won't let his actions consume me, but I don't ever owe him an iota of forgiveness.
I'm so glad you said that, because my mom is really trying to be big on forgiveness, to each their own. But for me, I don't see it in my heart ever because of the fact that I learned there was additional victims. A lot of children did flock to my grandma's house. If you hear me cringe at grandma, I don't call her grandma. I call her by her name. Kids would go there. All the incidents, I know there's many more victims that never came forward. I carried so much guilt as if I harmed a lot of these children. Family-wise, if a child is coming to you, take a second, listen. Yes, children are still little beings with huge feelings. And I believe that we have to acknowledge those feelings, especially if a child is scared. We have to acknowledge and say, okay, what scares you? If you feel something isn't right, just ask. It doesn't hurt to ask. Anyone that's healing, I believe that no process is going to look the same. It's going to be a roller coaster. It's okay to go backwards and forwards and backwards and come back forwards again because you're going to get there. It's very important to always remind yourself to be gentle with your healing. You're going to be angry because of what happened. You're going to have mixed emotions. It's okay to feel those feelings, especially if you were in the position of being told that it wasn't okay for you to feel that. Unfortunately, it's pretty common with a lot of upbringings that, oh no, you're fine. And I have found journaling to be very healing because I'm able to get out what I need to say, let it make a mess, let it be confusing because no one's going to read it but me. I'm able to express myself without feeling I have to explain or answer questions. It's healing to understand and hear your own voice and empower yourself. These things need to be brought to light because as I've seen so many times over, it's always the person you least expect. And I know that sounds so repetitive, but this is one of those situations you wouldn't even think it was possible, but these things happen. And it's so important, instead of deny or quickly brush off as this is not possible, to give the time of day to even question it. And I am so empowered right now to be able to speak up about things that I try and bury so deep. I feel very strongly that with this being out, that there may be a victim that hears my story that felt the same way. They won't believe me, or I have to not say anything because the way my family is going to separate. And yes, my family did separate in some portions, but it was more healing for me to find that peace and find my own voice than to worry about everyone and their feelings. Not to say that it's some easy, quick thing, but it's important to acknowledge you. It's important to remind yourself that you are worthy of all the truth and answers you need to move forward, to live a healthy life.
You are so incredible. I am deeply moved by everything that you've prevailed and overcome. Thank you again for everything that you're doing by sharing. Your story will absolutely resonate with many people. It resonated deeply with me in a lot of ways. Thank you for trusting me.
I cannot tell you the weight that has been lifted. I've never spoken out about my story. I was constantly told about the statute of limitations. After all those years of trying to validate my own self, I am now in this position. I've struggled because I've always fought this idea of him, that this was something that was not possible. How could that happen? For me to be able to speak up and say, yes, these things can happen when you don't even think they're capable. That's something that needs to be brought to light.
Intrafamilial child sexual abuse occurs when someone within the victim's family structure is the perpetrator of the abuse. Although statistics are hard to decipher because of the lack of reporting and the lack of reports being successfully filed, studies show that anywhere between 40 and 60% of victims of childhood sexual abuse are victimized by a family member. Statistically speaking, intrafamilial child sexual abuse also occurs at a significantly more prolonged rate in terms of abuse events than extrafamilial child sexual abuse, or abuse that is perpetrated by someone outside of the victim's family system. These statistics and the deep psychological impact that intrafamilial sexual abuse causes make it clear that prevention tactics are necessary. Increased awareness, related training programs for public health and safety professionals, and risk assessment protocol are all tools in preventing child sexual abuse. For more information on prevention, or if you suspect a child in your life is being abused, please visit the episode notes for a list of resources. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
When this guy would be molesting me later in life, I would also go to his family gatherings, Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter. He had two or three sisters and they're married with kids, and nobody ever said anything.
Thank you again to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to visit trymiracle.com/WCN and use the code WCN to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%. What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.